Well, good evening and welcome to the Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. It's wonderful to have a great crowd here tonight for an event that we were supposed to have in the darkest and stormiest part of winter on January 27th. And we were, as they say, snowed out because of a bad storm. But we are glad to be having this event this evening. My job is to introduce the gentleman who is going to introduce our speaker this evening, but I first of all want to do a little bit of library marketing and first of all remind you all that you'll be receiving your next issue of Notes in the mail any day. This is our newsletter, and I just wanted to thank all the library donors who continue to support the library so we can do programs like this evening. So watch for your issue of Notes. And if you're a guest with us tonight, there are copies of this down on the front desk as well, so please pick one up. My second job is to mention that tonight, if you buy a copy of the second edition of the Encyclopedia of New York City, we're going to make it very easy for you to carry it home. And we will actually put it in one of our Society Library bags, which has handles. It will go on your shoulder, and you can walk out the door with it. There are only 14 copies left outside, so you can avoid the rush at the end and scurry to buy one of the 14 remaining copies, and I'm sure Mr. Jackson would be willing to sign it for you as well. But without further ado, let me introduce Christopher Gray, a good friend of the library, former trustee, and he will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Mark. When I hear someone's name, I think when everybody hears someone's name, there's something that just flows into their brain automatically. It's just your own little personal piece of that person, and not the full person, but there's just something that comes to mind automatically. With Ken, depending on who you are, you may think of him as distinguished professor, author of Crabgrass Frontier, that groundbreaking work, editor of the Encyclopedia. I'm sure many of his students think of him as the sort of bicycle flaneur, right? Because he used to bring his students on bicycle tours. Were those the midnight bicycle tours, too? Oh, God. I would have flunked that course. I have an individual reaction, too. Unflappable. That's what I think of when I think of Ken Jackson. And it's all due to one incident. So this was right after the book was released, or very soon after the book was released. It might have been at the time he got the book one of the earliest book awards from the New York Society Library. And some well-meaning but assertive woman came up to him and said, in this tone of complete certainty, and my father taught me never to argue with somebody who knows they're right. And he was always right, incidentally. She said, "Well, she said, "Well, young man," but she didn't say that, but he kind of felt that way. She said, "Well, young man," and this is after Ken has labored to get this book out, and all the different writers and the photographs and the text. I mean, this is an absolute impossible undertaking. Not since I.N. Phelps Stokes, I would say, 100 years before. So here he is, and he's got his publisher, you know, the publishing, he must have run 50, 100,000 copies, something like that, right? And she says, "Young man," no, she didn't say young man. She said, "Well, this is a nice book, but you should really put it on the World Wide Web." Now, the significance of that, I'm sure, occurred to Ken immediately. "Right, lady, what I should do is stab my publisher in the back, give it away for free, and they'll have the book remaindered for the rest of my life." But because she wasn't aware of the reality, you know, it's got to be supported some way. And if it had been me, I don't think I would have slugged her or stepped on her. I might have stepped on her toe. But I can tell you steam would have been coming out of my ears, and it would have been very evident that I was, you know, outraged or at least very angry at the idea, not at the lady. But Ken said, "Oh, that's a fascinating idea. I had never thought of that. Let me think about that." So I present to you the unflappable Kenneth T. Jackson.
Thank you. Kind words from Chris Gray are music to the ears of anyone who's interested in history, because the good work that he puts into his research every week in the New York Times is most impressive, and if you put it all together, you'd have a very, very big and fine book. It's an honor to be here at the New York Society Library. You did give me a book prize for this book when it first came out 15 years ago, or 16 years ago at this point, just about. I'm also pleased that you've managed to survive for these 207 years now. Not easy to survive in New York, or 257 years, I'm sorry, for all these many years, and to recognize the importance of the printed word in the book and quiet reflection is terrific. And before I do anything else, I'd like to just introduce my executive editor, Lisa Keller, who is a native New Yorker and who went to Vassar College and then Cambridge University in England and got her PhD there and worked as a journalist in Europe for many years and then came back to become a professor at Purchase College of the State University of New York and recently finished a prize-winning book now in paperback called Triumph of Order, which is a comparison of London and New York over the last century and a half. And anyway, she took this book, which was, it was a lot of stuff, but it's a different, a book is more than just a lot of stuff. Somebody has to organize it and finish it. And Lisa, in almost 2 years of full-time effort, managed to transform this mass of information into what I think is really a wonderful book. And so she will be here to back me up and to add her own comments as we move through the evening. Our hope that this would be a conversation rather than a lecture. I've, of course, given a few lectures in my life and could easily do that. But I think it would be fun to have a conversation and to have you ask some questions. Before I do that, I'd like to just do two things. One is to show some images on the board, on the screen, that in some way may capture some of the essence of New York City. To talk a little bit about the encyclopedia, Lisa might want to add to that. To talk about the effort to capture New York City between two covers and think about the future maybe and just go into a conversational mode if you like, or questions. First though, let me just say a word about the effort to do this. Well, let's show the pictures first. Why don't we do that? Should we do that? You got the pusher? Let's do this first, and we'll go through some of the pictures. So we just, there's no way to really put New York in and get it down, but I think, go back to that previous one, that one with, I do think these are some of things that really make New York unique. We could think of public transportation, we could think of the cultural capital, we could think of many other things. But I think of these that make it unusual in the United States, toleration. Not that we're all tolerant, or not that other cities are not tolerant, but that the sheer size of New York City creates a kind of anonymity so that people can be strange or unusual if they want to be, and are not isolated as they might be in a small town situation. It's saying something about what pulls a great city together and what it means. And I think that starts with the Dutch, by the way, who early in the 17th century wanted to make money in New York, and that kind of shows how history runs through a long period of time. The Dutch, unlike the Puritans in Boston, don't really have they have religious, and they even have an established religion, but they don't care so much. And so they wouldn't have thrown Ian Hutchinson out as they did from Boston. Diversity or heterogeneity would be another thing that makes New York really unique in the world. Every place is heterogeneous now. So if Tokyo is not the largest city in the world, it's really not. It's really 99% Japanese. So when I say every place is, I really don't mean every place. But most American places are Canadian places, Australian places, European places. But New York is different from those in three ways. One is it's never had a really majority culture, even when the Dutch started it. The Dutch barely maintained a majority until they lost it to the English in we've never really had a dominant culture here. Secondly, it's unusual because of the sheer number of people represented. New York in 2000, we've still not seen the 2010 census, hard to believe on March 16th, but it's 2011, almost a year. So we don't know what the 2010 census will show, but the 2000 census counted more than 2.9 million persons within the five boroughs who were born in another country. That is 700,000 more than in London, and much more than any other city in the world, even in Los Angeles or Houston or Miami, which would have the highest percentage of foreign-born at 61%, but it's so much smaller of a city. And by the way, we're not counting all the people who are illegal here in New Jersey, even though they're here. And they weren't counted. We're only counting the people who were official. That's 2.9-something million. It'll probably be a few more than that in 2010. And thirdly, and in some ways most interesting, the diversity of the diversity, in the sense that the most numerous of the foreign-born group only makes up 14% of the foreign-born, and only about 4% of the city. You might know who that group would be? Dominican, people from the Dominican Republic. But, you know, the Chinese are gigantic, you know, the Russians, all the Hispanic groups are coming in, Mexicans are the fastest growing, though. Anyway, so it's just the diversity. Because when we think of Houston, we think of Chicanos, so people born in Mexico, we think of Miami, we think of Cuba, we think of Vancouver, you think of the Chinese. In New York, golly, you know, who knows? On the number 7 subway, every stop is another country. and it's the landmark for that reason. So I think diversity, we can say, really is a characteristic of New York that we can take to the bank. Aspiration is, it's a little more squiggly, but everybody talks about how everybody walks a little faster. This is not, it's not a quiet city, it's not the cleanest of cities, it's not the most gracious of cities, although it is all of those things. But if you want a life of ease, probably this is not the best choice. It's for people who want to become writers or violinists or basketball players or football players or researchers or whatever. In other words, it's kind of part of the American DNA to strive for something. You don't have to, but more often than in some cultures where, you know, just enjoy life and drink coffee all afternoon or something like that. But not the way mostly it's done in New York. And I would say that's one of the reasons New York is targeting 9/11, because the size of the World Trade Center overshadowing the people of the church in some ways tells people this doesn't look like Istanbul or Cairo or somewhere like this, that the gods we worship are different. Density, for a long time, until maybe 50 years ago, New York was uniquely dense. By density, I mean the number of people who crowd together in a small, by the way, crowding is good. This is one of the most crowded areas on earth that we're in, and also one of the most expensive. So it's vertical density, rather than people crowding into just a few square feet. But in any case, as late as the 1960, in terms of square feet of floor space, there were only two places on earth as dense as Midtown Manhattan. And one of them was Lower Manhattan. The other place was the Chicago Loop. Since that time, Hong Kong, Singapore, Beijing, Seoul have followed the New York model, New York-Chicago model. Europe did not, mostly. But nevertheless, density is still a real characteristic of New York. And this is what's really interesting as we see the census returns come in. Fairly, city to city. Anybody remember what the total was for Cleveland that came out the other day? 397,000. It had been 925 in 1950. 300. Or St. Louis. Do you remember that number? 319 in 2010. It had been 857 in 1950. We don't know yet. Detroit was somewhere from the under 800,000. That had almost 2 million in 1950. And we could go on and talk about Pittsburgh or Buffalo or Newark or Baltimore, even Boston, or Chicago, which is smaller now than it was in 1950. What makes New York interesting? One of the many things that makes New York interesting is the density is not only high, and if you want to talk about numbers of people per square mile, it will be 30,000 roughly in New York, 35,000. No other city will be, big city will be even half that in the United States. So we're talking about many more people. I tell people all the time, and I love Chicago, that in some ways, Chicago is closer to a farm than New York, in terms of numbers of people per square mile. But what's interesting is that in most of American cities, and the ones I just mentioned, I'll call them, the density is lower now than it was in 1950. That's been the experience of our life. People have moved out to the suburbs, and the middle of the city has been like a balloon that's been squeezed. The only two exceptions, well, there are three exceptions, one is San Francisco. The other is Los Angeles, and that's kind of a weird exception because it had a lot of empty space in its legal boundaries in 1950 that got filled up after World War II, so it's not really the same thing in New York City. What makes New York City unique is not that people move to Scarsdale or Florida, but that somebody else has taken the place. So we're quite sure that in the 2010 census, they will show several 100,000 more people in the same space in New York. And so that's unusual. So it means that New York is about density. I think that's a good thing, and I think that's what most people think. And then change. And this may be the most important characteristic. We'll run this because I promise I wouldn't talk. But even though this neighborhood, let's just think of this neighborhood, it's changed relatively little since 1950. I mean, certainly anybody who's come back, the buses run on the transverse roads across Central Park are in the same place, and the subway stops in the same place, and most of the buildings reach the same height and look the same. But what the city does is different. 6 years ago, this was the leading industrial city in the world. The world. Not because of aircraft factories or automobile factories or steel mills, but because of women, most of women sewing buttons long ago, making cigars or brewing beer or doing half a hundred other things. And so that the sheer number of people engaged in manufacture was greater and value added by manufacturing was greater than any other city. Of course, Berlin and Tokyo and Moscow and not really involved in all, but they weren't very competitive, but story is a story. 6 years ago, New York was the busiest port in the world. And there were at least 100,000 people whose jobs depended on unloading bags and boxes in the harbor, probably many more than that. What's happened to both of those two characters is they're gone. They're not really gone, but we've gone from a million plus manufacturing jobs to about 150,000. It was probably at every row of your full minimum. You want your labels to be here, not in the ocean, or shipping, and they're taking something like that. And then the ships, this is still a big, busy port. But the difference is it's now a container ship coming in on the back up, and they come over to Port York, and three guys can now do in 8 hours what 100 people can do in 3 days, 6 years ago. So the jobs aren't there. What's interesting about New York, and we can talk about this in discussion, is that somehow it was able to do so far what other American cities, other old industrial, Midwestern, Northeastern cities have been unable to do, which is to shift and do something else. Detroit obviously hasn't. Cleveland obviously hasn't. Buffalo obviously hasn't. St. Louis hasn't. And that's why the cities are thinking, and New York has so far. We don't know what's happening in 20 years. We could talk about others, but those are, I think, distinctive. Let's change it again. Let's run through them very quickly just so we can talk. So let's just go through that.
Can I just point out
yes.
that all of these illustrations are new in this edition. We have 800 illustrations. We had 800 illustrations in the first edition, and 400 are new. Well, Ken, tell pictures were taken by a group of young photographers who were volunteer their time. Actually, I happen to take this picture, but that's just incidental. I took a number of them also. But we had a number of aerials received. A photographer went up and did aerial shots. Every time he went up, he got airs. So that shows real devotion. So.
Anyway, Sylvia's is, of course, the most famous African-American restaurant in Harlem, and that's part of the diversity theme there, and it does well at 125th and Lenox, 126th Lenox. The Museum of Jewish Heritage, which is both us, reminds us this is the largest, I think, still Jewish city in the world, or largely a place in Israel. The bodegas, which we associate with the Hispanic population, of which in some ways New York is the last refuge of the little mom-and-pop store that's disappeared so much in the United States. Katz's Deli, down on Houston Street, is, I think, Ludlow, but interesting because, well, this is the famous Harry Met Sally scene, but also interesting because, speaking of the theme of change, for 40 years I've been teaching students at Columbia University and been taking them out around the city and walking up Orchard Street and Ludlow and Essex and Lansing to show them the worst urban houses the United States ever produced. And of course, now I have to point out that across the street in the Senate is the exact same apartment. It's on the Sonitor Building plus dollars now. And one of the hottest neighborhoods in New York City, if not the hottest, is the Lower East Side. So there's change. Well, this is also diversity. This is Atlantic Avenue. Again, and of course, one of the things, too, about New York, and I think about toleration, there's nothing wrong with love with each other, but it is quite remarkable how little violence there is, let's say, between the Palestinians and the Jews in New York. Adalbert was once a young Lubavitch boy who was shot on the Brooklyn Bridge maybe 20 years ago, but that's 20 years ago. Think of Yugoslavia and the Croats and the Serbs and the Bosnians and what they have been doing to each other over in the Balkans for so long, and yet they're all here in New York, and they kind of bury the hatchet here. Or the Pakistanis and the Indians who are threatening nuclear war over Kashmir, and yet they're all in Queens, all in Jackson Heights, and somehow managed to get along and not fight. Anyway, I think that's a remarkable story, but never an assassination. Probably has had more heads of state here than any place in human history. Change it. Density, just want to pick up this, that Stuyvesant Town. Well, Stuyvesant Town, you know, on the East River, post-World War II, big housing project, white, metropolitan life. I think that's where Lisa grew up.
I wouldn't call it a housing project.
Middle income.
Very upset that you called it that.
But middle income. But still, high density, tower in the park sort of thing. Change it. Then, of course, you look at Battery Park City. All this, of course, is landfill. Landfill from the World Trade Center, which is right in here. That's changed. Well, that World Trade Center itself was on landfill. This, is, of course, is the North River Sewage Treatment Plant, the Hudson River around the 130s. The 140s, which is 28 acres over the river, sewage treatment, but on top of it, you know, soccer fields and skating rinks and tennis courts and basketball courts and a high-end restaurant right down here called Riverview, I think. And believe it or not, it really doesn't smell. It's also very safe because if anything bad happens, the police can just cut these two things right here. It's very hard to get off. Change anything? Well, all the change down the Lower West Side of the Hudson River, the exact title that they give it now, but it's really a dramatic change on the Lower West Side of New York with the bike paths, the new revived piers and everything else. Change it. And by the way, the whole New York City has changed because if you think about it, 50, 60 years ago, New York was a wedding place. The big buildings and the area of highest residential income development were in the middle, along the central spine called Fifth Avenue or Central Park. What's happened in the last 20 years is the rezoning of the edges of the city. So most of the growth has been pushed out toward the river channel. So it's a very different city now than it was then. Bedford-Stuyvesant, really nice round stones. And of course, we live in an era of dramatic demographic change. One reason we want to see what happened during the 2010 census is we're wondering what the changes are. Chicago, stunningly, lost 200,000 black citizens in the last 10 years. 200,000. Only went up through the 20th century and now down 200,000. White population down a little bit, but the city is definitely becoming whiter. Not sure yet whether those blacks move to the suburbs, which is the sign of goodwill, or to Atlanta, or whatever, but we're surely going to see somewhat the same in New York. For Harlem, if you may have noticed, is less than half black. And there's huge gentrification in those neighborhoods. Change it. Here's something, just to, what do we remember about the past? Of course, this is an interesting story. You know, we all remember the Boston Massacre. Only six people got shot or killed. Hardly anybody remembers the General Slocum. By the way, to stay on the same thing, nobody remembers the Battle of Brooklyn, which is the biggest battle of the American Revolution. But we don't remember because we lost, because we decided to put that out of our minds. But here, the General Slocum, which was the worst disaster in New York history. In fact, by some measures, it's even worse than the World Trade Center as a proportion of the metropolitan or city population. More than 1,000 people died in 1904, mostly women and children, mostly infants. And you know what? That little monument is in Tompkins Square Park. It's about this side. It's a real
picture. And you can't find it.
And it's hard to find. Meanwhile, the World Trade Center, of course, we're going to have a $500 billion monument. I'm not saying it shouldn't. But it is interesting how we memorialize certain events. Now, that was in the Triangle Fire, which is going to be remembered this month. All there is left is a little plaque on the wall. But you have to know what you're looking for, or you won't see it. Change it. Go Flamander Walk. You know, think of all the little secrets in New York. A lot of the Upper West Siders will recognize Flamander Walk, those little English Tudor houses between, I guess, 95th and 94th, just west of Broadway. But there are these little secrets all around the city. Sylvan Terrace in Upper Manhattan, you know, Arthur Avenue, Indoor Market. There are lots of little places like this that are little treasures in the city. Change it. Strauss Square, right across from this used to be the Jewish Daily Forward right here, and the Seward Park Public Library is right over here, and this used to be the dairy bar where Trotsky used to hang out. The change in the Lower East Side, which we just talked about, we'll just change it. The Time Warner Building, when you think of the changes in New York City, the economic transformation of the city, which continues to be huge, as some functions move out of the city, others move in. One of the things that's happened is becoming an even bigger media communication center than it already was. So if you think of the run between 42nd Street and Times Square up to 59th Street Columbus Circle, that's where Hearst is, that's where Comedy Nast is, this is where Time Warner is, where Burleson is, you know, this main sign here, which is such a center for this, change it to a real symphony space, I think. I mean, the other thing we could talk about is New York is a cultural center. Middle East becomes the world's cultural center as it begins to lose its industry after World War II to the south and west, partly because the German army marches through Paris in 1940. New York benefits more than any other place because of European intellectuals. And symphony space sort of picks up on that. Or jazz, which starts in New Orleans, makes its way up the Mississippi River, the Mississippi, side trip to Kansas City, Chicago is big. Migrates to New York City in the 1920s or 30s, and New York City has been the jazz capital of the world since then, and still is. Change it. And Coney Island, we could talk a lot about Coney Island, we don't have time. This is the cyclone right here. This is the new, used to be 5 railroad trains, now it's 5 subways, and it looks a little bit different from that now, but such a major thing in American history, and the beach. Just to say one thing, Warren, a big day in Disney World in Orlando with 100,000 people. If they got 100,000 people every day, they'd be delighted. The big day coming out 7,500 years ago, we didn't know. So Disney World's a small operation compared to Coney Island and its peak. Now I'm counting the beach, too. And the other thing was the all this all Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse rather than Games of Chance. But anyway, it's another story. But when baseball, this is of course the new Citi Field at, and of course we know now that baseball probably had much more to do with New York City than with Cooperstown, but nevertheless. But the whole transformation of leisure and sports in American history, which you know, all of our sports, mostly baseball, basketball, football, started on the last part of the 19th century. Usually started around cities, and when you think of baseball, it started on the New York City. Change it? Then change. Well, World Trade Center, obviously an important story. And if you want to talk about it, we'll talk about it in a minute. We'll change it. The rebuilding, and now you know the World Trade Center is up to about 40 stories. It's called what?
Number one.
Anyway, it's...
There is no Freedom Tower.
Okay. But anyway, it's up. It's not like it's for so many years it was down. It's gone. Change it. And, of course, the spires of Midtown Manhattan, which still is a distinctive skyline around the world that makes New York unique, and not only the people working tall buildings, they live in tall buildings. You know, Paris, they live at high density, but they don't work at tall buildings. And in Tokyo, it's the reverse. They work in tall buildings, but they don't live in tall buildings. New York is a different model. We do both. And therefore, you get an unusual density on the street and a mix, change it, if you will. And here's another way that we can look about the change of the city. This, of course, is the Brooklyn Bridge, and this is the Manhattan Bridge. And the area between them is called Dumbo, down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass. But this picks up the changes in the city. This was industrial, fading industrial, but industrial 30 years ago, paper boxes, among other things. There was a lot of those buildings have, I think, GAIR written on G-A-I-R, is that right? GAIR number 6, GAIR number 5. Now, of course, it's been converted into condominiums and art galleries and places where you can buy chocolate for $50 a pound or whatever it costs or some big number like that. And St. Anne's Warehouse, which is a place for theaters and stuff like this. So this whole area, and indeed the whole Brooklyn waterfront, Williamsburg over this way, this is the Jewish Highway in Trivial Pursuit, the Williamsburg Bridge, but that whole area has been completely revitalized in recent years by young people being pushed out of Manhattan, feel like they're being pushed out. They don't go to Hoboken all the time. They go off into Williamsburg. Change it. The High Line, I love the High Line. The High Line is a railroad, 20 feet in the air, or maybe a little more, that was conceived or built in the 30s mostly, to go down the west side of Manhattan in a desperate attempt to save the industrial jobs on the lower west side. They thought they could run these freight railroads into the building, I mean into and through the building, so that we deliver raw materials to them and they send something back out, it might save these jobs. And obviously, it might be better jobs. It was a failure. It didn't work, I don't know, and finally in about 1975, they gave up the ghost. Had some turkeys on the train, that was the end of it. And it just sat there for 30 years. And only in Europe would nobody notice that there's this above ground railroad that's because, you know, we just kind of get used to everything here. And there was a guy that lived up there in a caboose for a long time. But what's interesting is that it was turned into a lot of energetic people into a linear park. But where else, these are weeds, by the way, they're intentionally weeds. But it's an incredible tourist attraction. People all over the world are coming to see this thing, which failed at what it was intended to do, and now is succeeding at what it was not intended to do. And right there below it is the old Nabisco company, Chelsea Market, you know, which is where the Oriole Pictures was embedded. But now that's been changed into their television studios and all these activities in Chelsea Market and food distributors, and not food distributors, food providers all over the place. Across the street, Google has just paid $2.6 billion for one of the largest buildings in the United States. The biggest Empire State Building, just the top side. But it shows how the city is changing a bit, changing if you would. Or Chelsea Piers nearby. This is where the Titanic was heading. And this was, ocean liner years and stuff in the low 20s. Now this is a golf driving range. Farther over there's tour boats and cruise boats, reflecting that the harbor is now being cleaned up. And also we don't have hundreds of tramp steamers there anymore. And then we have basketball courts and ice skating rinks and television studios and high-end, venues for blacktop artists as fundraisers. Anyway, that's change. I mean, it's what it was built for, what it's being used for, are very different things. Change. And then the Atlantic Boat Basin, this is in Brooklyn, close to where the QMQ is coming down, but this was built in the early 19th century, is a kind of refuge for boats. And now Red Hook in Brooklyn and places like that are becoming different kinds of neighborhoods. Change it again. We'll come back to it. Under the Brooklyn Bridge, Park is going down this way and this way, under the promenade. There were for years, generations really, ferry boats that went back and forth. Some are trying to start again. This is the municipal building. Change it again. Domino Sugar. This was the sugar refining place. More sugar refined here. Let's talk about industrial uses. This is on the East River on the Brooklyn side. Now following the modern pattern. The sugar refining is gone. The sign is still there. And that's going to be turned into condos or luxury rentals, whatever you want to call it. Change it. The West Side Rail Yard, which are, this by the way is the High Line right here. It's running here, but this hasn't been turned into a High Line yet. But this is where they're going to spend, we think, billions of dollars to build more skyscrapers, rather like they've done in the West Side of the East. That's that how. So there we are. So that's just some of these right now. Now, before we go to questions, let me just say a couple more words, and I ask Lisa to comment on the Encyclopedia of Yale. And let me hold it up. This is as big as 25 books. It's got more than 2 million words. A normal monograph will come in at 75,000, or maybe a few more, but not much. But this is as big as 25 words. I think it's the more words and more facts about any one city that has ever been put together about any city ever anywhere. I think it's the best urban encyclopedia in the world. Of course, part of that's because there aren't that many. There is one for London, by the way. There's one for Chicago and for New Jersey. New York City, Indianapolis, and Cleveland, Louisville, and working on one in Milwaukee, and places like that. But this one's, I think, it's been successful critically, and more successful than any other commercial. I mean, this grade engine sales figures, we think adding the two editions together will be the first encyclopedia to sell, urban encyclopedia to sell 100,000 copies.
Is it about the same size?
Bigger. This is about 20% bigger. It looks exactly the same. And we've got a little bit thinner paper. We've got hundreds more pages. The index in the first one was 30-something pages. The index in this one is 100 pages. Much like 100. And as Lisa Keller said, 800 new issues.
We've
got a few. Dead, white, then. Yes, it did, but not as good. If George Washington had an entry, which he did, then you wouldn't have George Washington in there. Even though he might be mentioned in 27 other articles. So it really wasn't very useful.
That was a London encyclopedia, that's
but it doesn't have people in London. And Chicago does. And it turns out that a lot of what people actually look for in this encyclopedia is you open a page, any page, it doesn't matter. And I think part of the reason for its success, it's serendipitous. The thing about a computer and Wikipedia or whatever is you find what you're looking for. In this book, you find what you're not looking for. You thought you were interested in the Society of Umbers, but it turns out it's the Society for the Prevention of Crime or something like that. No, it's something else. Or here you've got Broadway theaters by seating capacity or theaters within the present boundaries of New York City by their native founder. But it's the serendipity of it. Secondly, another important thing is that it's written by experts. You know, no 13-year-old working in his basement can change the, you know, someone in Kentucky can change the entry.
Well, was there a sizable editorial committee?
Well, we had a lot of folks and editors involved in that. Yeah, no one person can know that. In fact, when I first started, by the way, it was Yale's idea. Well, people say, why did Yale do it? Well, they came to me in 1982 and asked me if I would do it. So their idea was their book. But part of it was to put people in it, and part of it was to make it just A to Z. Because that's not as obvious as you think. There's an encyclopedia of Southern culture and another one of New England culture, which is not A to Z. It's broken up into politics or sports or women. But what if it's a female sports fan? You know, or then they've got histories of category. What does John F. Kennedy say? Politics or ESPN? You know, you can't do it. Whereas this one, it is what it is. It turns out to be a lot easier to use. I'll just be quick. I think the other thing about it that should be mentioned is the price is in place. Most encyclopedias this size sell for $1,000. And they come out in $10. And they're selling it to New York Society Library, or the Des Moines Public Library, or the Oklahoma State University Library. They're not intended for people. It's private. This book, which is bigger than those things, and they crammed it in the one and decided to retail it at $65 because they wanted ordinary people to buy it. And I noticed they got it for $50 here, so even discounted from that and throwing carry on. But it's an incredible deal. When you think that most history monographs now do a dissertation, 220 pages at Cambridge University Press Publishing, it's 75 times. And this is 35 times up there. And the price of it is 10 cents. So it's a terrific deal. And then the final thing I think I would say about it is that people do, I don't say that people don't love other cities, I'm sure they do, but I do think that people who have lived in New York have an emotional tie to it, even if they move back to Portland, Oregon or somewhere else, and they often buy it. They think that they're a little different, maybe a little tougher because they lived in New York for a while, and therefore they want to feel this connection. And so it's done very well outside of New York as well. Lisa, what new would you add to my comments about this type of thing?
Well, I think people should, we should open up the floor to questions, and then we can answer some questions people might have. I would say that Ken's comment about the people who worked on this, everyone who worked on this did it really for love. Almost no one got paid. A few of the editors got paid, but most everybody did it just because they wanted to have their name in here as a contributor to the book. I want to acknowledge Tony Granowitz, who's here, who's one of the contributors and who worked very tirelessly on many of the entries. And we have a great debt to them. The book is intended, one thing I'll say before we open up is the book is intended as both a beginning and an end in a way. That it's a place to start if you're doing research. And if you, on the other hand, and if you think you know a lot about New York, guess what? You're going to find something you don't know about in the book. And a sort of joy is in flipping through. But the other thing I want to remind everybody here is, Ken and I are both professors at universities. You are all New Yorkers with a great deal of vested interest and experience in this city. A younger generation is coming up that does not know a lot about the city. And it is to them that this encyclopedia is probably the greatest service, because we want them to know about the city before it's too late. And we tried to modernize it as much as we could. We didn't have enough time and we didn't have enough money. Otherwise, the project would have gone for another 5 or 6 years, as Ken and I discuss all the time if we waited. But we do want people to use this as a source that is in the best sense of encyclopedia, a place to start, and a non-biased place. We had one review, which I was very, very happy about, which actually criticized us for being so unbiased. And I thought, well, then it's really, we have succeeded in doing what, the reviewer didn't like one of the facts that we had in the encyclopedia, because it was a fact about a controversial issue in New York, And we sort of presented it kind of in a moderate tone without showing the size. One entry, the World Trade Center in the first edition, has become 15 entries in this edition. There have been many other expansions. We've added some 450 neighborhoods, more than 100 ethnic groups, so there's a lot going on. So why don't we...
And one thing we should say is, unlike other encyclopedias, except for something like London, we couldn't put everything in. There was a lot of the criticism is you didn't put in St. Just Church, or, but if you put in every church, or even if you put in any suburb, there are 1,500 suburbs. At some point, then the book gets too big and it becomes too long, and then it's no longer what it was intended to be. So you have to make choices.
You have to make choices. I would have taken out a few more churches, but I did manage to get two new entries, synagogues and mosques in there. So we did add that in New York. So that was something. Also, I want to comment on the index. Somebody questioned about it. Our index, and I was also pleased that at least one reviewer mentioned this, this is a very unusual index. This is not an index, oh, I'm going to find this on page so-and-so. This is an index of connections of people in New York. So if you want to find out when Langston Hughes was living, who he associated with, we cut it off at 15. You can look up 15 people that you may not know he had connections with. So that index provides that cross-referencing, and we think it is the only index of its type of any kind of reference book. You might be wrong, but that's what we think. So why don't we answer some of your questions?
Yes. Yes,
sir. Do you have one, two, or three items that are kind of favorites to viewers, or particularly because they might be quirky or something that surprised you?
Well, two or three that I like, and as Lisa said, most of the scholarship here is derivative. The people who wrote it already knew a lot of that whenever they were doing it, so they're, we've done World War II, and then, he just wrote a book about World War II, which he did. But sometimes the work is unique. The railroad combinations that came together to form the railroads of New York is not, it goes on the pages. The only place that's done. The list of songs about New York, or the list of newspapers, and by the way, more newspapers in New York than any other place in the world. Why? Because we only had so many of these different ethnic groups. And it's the only list of all the newspapers ever published in New York. So those are the ones I like. And also the list. Bronx Borough Crisis. Who gives a damn? We've got it. Worst fires in New York. You know what I mean?
Fire commissioners.
What?
Episcopal bishops.
You know, all sorts of stuff.
I lost that one.
But, lots of lists like that.
We have more than 100 charts and tables. And again, 80 to 90% will revise, and there are at least 30 brand new ones. And let me tell you something, checking those charts, fact-checking, getting the stuff right, that was an area that didn't exist. So that stuff is mostly new that we've compiled ourselves. And we're not even compiling them.
Questions?
I enjoyed your photographs, mostly with the clear air and the pictures. Do you know the history of air pollution in the city? Did it get worse up until a particular day, and how it's gotten better after?
He said about history of air pollution. There are, by the way, a huge new field of environmental in the work and everywhere else. I don't think there's a clear thing in Europe like there was in London, or, in 1948 or whatever, you couldn't see your breathing if you went outside. Because most of the industry, we weren't heating by coal mostly. And it wasn't that damp that the holes were. But I think the air is probably better. But it's not, we have entries on the environment, on rats, on cockroaches, stuff like this. But we try to include the natural environment. I don't think that the environmental air quality, I don't even know if we have an entry on air quality.
Not on air quality, we have pollution.
Well, I can't tell you what, by the way, I don't presume, and I'm sure Lisa doesn't either, but we know everything on this farm. When I started on it, I'm sure it's got Ed Tripp came to me, and I found out that there was a guy named Edward Ellis, who was good. Does anybody know the name of Edward Ellis?
Great New York.
What?
He kept a diary.
The longest diary. wrote a book called The Ethics of New York City, pretty good book. And he was going to do it by himself. Well, and so I said, okay, I'm not going to do it. Somebody else is already doing it. And the person here said, well, don't worry. If anybody's trying to do this by themselves, it isn't going to work. And I went to see Edward Ellis. He lived near General Theological Seminary down in Chelsea. I went into his apartment. The whole apartment was probably no bigger than this room. But the stacks of paper, you know, were this hot. You know, folders and all folders and stuff. There's no one way, one person. By the time you finish banking, shipping is out of there. You know, you just can't do it. It's just one person.
There were 800 contributors. From the first edition to the second edition, 100 died. And then there were probably close to another 100 people who worked on the book in one fashion or another.
Lisa, the dead white male.
Dead white male.
Give us a couple of dead white males.
Oh, I can't, because I'm happy to say that that happened before I came on.
Were dead white male organizations?
Well, I think they were so unknown that I couldn't even tell you who they were.
Okay, great, I see. So you're saying the New York Society Library is not in the book. Okay,
well, sure it isn't.
That's good.
I think it's in there.
You can ad lib it.
It's in there.
Just
point.
Probably anything that's 100 years old, I think automatically, even a restaurant. You know, if you can survive 100 years, you can be in this book.
What are some themes that could have been in the previous volume, not the World Trade Center attacks, but could have been the previous volume, but made it into this volume?
Synagogues and mosques were two really critical omissions. You can't, in the world's largest Jewish city, not have an entry on synagogue. In the beginning, we did argue about this a little bit, and I pointed out there was an entry on churches. So if you have an entry on churches, you need those kind of entries. Another entry, which again we had, I also teach women's history, was trying to increase the number of women, and also to omit mentions of their marital and sexual mores, which I think was not necessarily appropriate. We had a tendency to say whether a woman was married or divorced, but we never mentioned that for men. So we had to equalize that. Elizabeth Jennings, anyone who knows about Elizabeth Jennings? She's in this edition. She is probably a great one. There should be a plaque to Elizabeth Jennings, a monument to Elizabeth Jennings in New York City, because she integrated the New York public transit system in 1854, long before Rosa Parks. She was kicked off of a tram, and she sued, and she got the right to be on public transportation. That was, again, we weren't so much looking for her as a contributor came to us and told us about this person, and that's how some of that happened. So that's some of the additional 800 entries that went.
You know, to come back to your question, Chris, I was involved with, I went to University of Chicago, I was involved with the Chicago Encyclopedia, which was a good book. But I just opened, a month ago, just opened them both to the essays or something. And they're different in the sense that this one has more shorter entries. Because I think that's, my experience has been that's what people look up. Whereas theirs would have entries on social service reform. Well, who's looking that up? And they have a long entry, you know what I mean? And so they had many fewer entries and longer, more heavier entries, I would say. But the feedback I got over 15 years where people were saying it was on the northwest corner, not the northeast corner, or I should have this person and not that person, hardly anybody ever wrote to me saying, you didn't have longer general intellectual. We have an entry on intellectual or something like that. Well, even those get a little, or literary, yeah. Literature. And most authors, it's tough to get all the way through them.
Now, I also would say that in many cases, I saw some of these complaints about facts. There are some things you are never, ever going to be able to absolutely pin down in New York City. And one of them, and I think all of you are probably aware of this, is neighborhood boundaries. Because you're probably aware that while everyone lives in a neighborhood, they don't actually exist legally. They are
neighbors. You know, people said there's no such place as Harlem. No such place as Greenwich Village.
Or
I mean, legally, they don't have a mayor. The city planning commission does not recognize it. They have different kinds of boundaries, not about neighborhoods.
We were in the Brooklyn Public Library, and we had a discussion about a neighborhood. I think three women almost got in a fist fight.
Because where were they? comes in bigger. Whereas in Germany, if the neighborhood is supposed to be this green, that's what it means. It doesn't change, but in our society, in this city, it sort of does.
But you can email us with your corrections. We have a new address. We have an email account, and we are...
And also, we have new neighborhoods, because that's where we celebrate. We create new
neighborhoods.
Dumbo, Warren Hill, all this stuff. Yes.
I had a curious series. I had read Chernow's book on Hamilton, and I had read that he was buried in Trinity Church. So I go to Trinity Church because I want to go down and see, because I really like that book, like Hamilton. And they had no record. So
Trinity Church had no record? Or we
had no record of Alexander Hamilton being buried.
Well, he is buried there. He's buried in their church. Must have been there any number of them. So whoever told you that needs to know their own cemetery.
They looked it up, they got back.
Well, they might just wander around the graveyard and
have a tour.
Alexander Hamilton, his wife Elizabeth Scholars, what's not known about Alexander Hamilton very much, is he died at 82 James Street. Well, even if you're looking for that marker, and I mean looking for it, it's so small that this is where he died. I don't know where we're supposed to be. You almost can't find it. Alexander Hamilton is the towering figure.
Time for one more question.
We don't have the plaque.
I made a speech on Thomas Jefferson once in New York, but I don't know.
We don't have the plaque itself in the book.
Does it even exist? I'm not sure there's anything on Thomas Jefferson was here. Didn't like New York. But I don't think there's. You know, we have entries on lots of presidents who spent a little bit of time in New York. Marcus Cullen, will we have you to stay around, sign books, answer questions, whatever you want.
Thank you very much.